Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
Greetings and welcome to ID the Future. I'm Casey Luskin, broadcasting with Discovery Institute Center for Science and Culture in Seattle, Washington. Today we have on the show with us University of British Columbia at Vancouver faculty member Richard Johns, who teaches in the philosophy department, who recently published an article titled Self-Organization in Dynamical Systems, a Limiting Result in the philosophy journal Synthes. The article has already received some attention at the blog Uncommon Dissent, and we have the author, Richard Johns, on the phone with us today. So, Dr. Johns, thank you so much for being on the show with us.
Well, thanks for having me.
Well, I'm very interested in your paper. It provides a critique of self-organization arguments for the origin of biological complexity. So I'm really looking forward to getting into some of these issues with you today. So I was wondering if we could just start off with some very basic questions about self-organization. Maybe you could just explain for our listeners, what is self-organization?
Well, the term is used in physics and biology in slightly different ways, but the general idea that a certain object or certain kind of structure appears in the world, as it were, by itself, without it being produced by something external. And in particular, it emerges just by the operation of the laws of physics and the general properties of matter. So some easy examples of self-organization would be things like crystals. You don't need to put a crystal together atom by atom. It just sort of forms by itself in a solution that gets concentrated enough. Just some general conditions have to obtain, and it just happens.
You also discussed structures like a vortex as being an example of self-organization.
Yeah, so the circular shape, you know, when you drain a bathtub, and similar shapes actually with just the sort of swirling shape of a galaxy as it operates under gravity. Similar things with the spherical shape of a star. Again, just the sort of a minimum end viewpoint with the gravitational field or something of that sort. A lot of circular shapes, rotating shapes, self-organized.
So you mentioned in your post on Uncommon Dissent, Dr. Johns, that some people have compared self-organization to magic. And so I'd like to ask you, is self-organization magic? And if not, is it very far removed from magic?
Well, not magic in that there are several pure examples of self-organization. I might have said that sometimes people attribute kind of magical powers to self-organization. I think I meant that some people imagine that self-organization can accomplish extraordinary things that, from my point of view, don't seem physically possible. People maybe are a bit uncritical about self-organization and its abilities.
Fair enough. Now, I want to get into some of the arguments that you make in your paper and your critique of self-organization. You discuss what you call the limitative theorem, and I was wondering if you could explain that for our listeners and how that applies to self-organization.
Right. But I start by arguing in the paper that there must be some kind of limitations to self-organization, because if certain objects have a preference, that is, if the laws prefer certain objects to appear, it means that others are less preferred. So it's just a matter of trying to figure out which ones self-organizing objects are. And my limitative theorem says that, in particular, large objects that are very irregular, that is, they're not self-similar. They're not just the same thing over and over again, but the different parts are kind of different from one another. So large, irregular objects can't self-organize. That's what the theorem says.
When you just mentioned large, irregular objects, could that sort of incorporate the concept of specified complexity, where you don't have a repeating pattern over and over again, but there is some specification as well as complexity involved in the object? Is there a similarity there?
There's some relation, yeah. I don't have a concept of specification because that's not really relevant. I mean, that concept arises from trying to make some kind of design inference, which is not something I do in the paper.
And that's totally fair. As a matter of fact, you make it very clear in your post at Uncommon Dissent, Dr. Johns. If you don't mind, I'll just quote from it briefly. You say, while the paper doesn't address intelligent design as such, it indirectly establishes strict limits to what such evolutionary mechanisms as natural selection can accomplish. In particular, it shows that physical laws operating on initially random arrangement of matter cannot produce complex objects with any reasonable chance in any reasonable time. And so I think that's a very, very fair statement of what you're arguing here. You're not arguing for intelligent design, but you are arguing that there are limits to natural selection. So I'd like to talk about some of those ideas. You talk in your paper about conservation of information a little bit, or you compare your arguments to that. What is the concept of conservation of information?
It's a loose idea right now. There are some results that I have basically in probability theory that could be described in those terms. Although, as I say in the paper, conservation might be misleading. It's more like a non-amplification, because as far as I can tell, information can be lost. It can't be gained, as it were. And it's also a probabilistic thing that information can be gained, but just not very quickly and not very probably. But the results I have start actually in the context of logic and just the idea that in a valid argument, one where the conclusion follows from the premises, the conclusion can't have more information in it than the premises do. So that's your basic sort of non-amplification result, which is almost a tautology, really. But then because in a dynamical system, anything that will happen with a certain probability has to be, as it were, logically derivable from the laws and the initial state, so that there are, as it were, logical constraints on what can happen dynamically. The simplest example is with a deterministic system, whatever happens actually has to be logically necessary given the laws in the initial state. And more generally, if something has a certain physical probability, it also has to have the same epistemic probability given, again, the laws in the initial state. So this conservation of information you get in logical arguments has a sort of an analogy with dynamical systems.
Yes, I found that to be a very interesting part of your argument, and that you're applying this conservation of information concept to logic. And you write in your paper, the basic idea of these conservation theorems is that logical consequences requires the premise to contain more information than the conclusion. Note, this is only a necessary condition for logical consequence, not a sufficient one. And then you go on to say, as Chaitin put it, I would like to be able to say that if one has 10 pounds of axioms and a 20-pound theorem, then the theorem cannot be derived from those axioms. Is this basically what you're arguing?
The idea that deductive logic is non-ampliative is well understood and accepted, but trying to describe it in terms of information content is fairly new, I think, although people like Chaitin have been doing this. But I think the analogy between logical arguments and dynamical systems hasn't been sufficiently appreciated. It actually derives from something philosophers call the principle about probabilities. It's a rather silly name, principal principle, which is the idea that if you know the chance of something occurring, then your degree of belief, your epistemic probability, should take the same value. So if, for example, you know that the chance of a horse winning is 0.6, then a gamble that pays you a dollar if he wins is worth 60 cents, given that information, that kind of idea that establishes that chances and logical probabilities or epistemic probabilities are equal. That's, for me, the basis of conservation of information in physics.
So this makes a lot of sense. So I'd like to change the direction here to talk about Darwinian evolution. How does all of this apply to neo-Darwinian evolution? And why do you feel, as you argue in your paper, that Darwinian processes are a form of self-organization?
Right. I've had some discussion with people since I posted on Uncommon Descent about this, because biologists don't talk of evolution as a self-organizing process. In fact, while some people, particularly Stuart Kaufman, talk about evolution as including self-organization, it's seen as complementary to the usual mechanisms like natural selection. So it's a bit innovative to say that the whole thing is self-organization. But according to the definition that I have, which is a fairly broad definition, some people define self-organization more narrowly. But according to my broad definition, it is straightforwardly a case of self-organization, just because the whole process happens a lot more quickly and with much greater probability than it would if you had just sort of a purely random arrangement of matter.
I guess this raises the question, is life a machine, and why is it not possible for machines to self-organize?
Well, life is a machine, according to the standard picture. Why couldn't machines self-organize? Well, according to me, it's because they have an irregular structure. So they're not like crystals, which is just the same unit repeated endlessly. They have different parts that are differentiated. You know, the different parts of an engine aren't all the same. And I've got my limitative theorem that says it's very difficult for irregular objects that are large to self-organize.
Fair enough. So if you could elaborate just a little bit on why you feel that Darwinian evolution cannot explain certain aspects of biological complexity, or why self-organization arguments in general are inadequate to account for the origin of life.
Well, my argument doesn't especially address Darwinian evolution. It just addresses self-organization theories in general, of which that's one. But usually we're supposed to just see that this is possible. You know, as we look at some complex structure and the Darwinian says, well, you know, I can imagine this coming about by a series of small steps, each of which is advantageous and so forth. And to me, it's just not clear that this is possible. I mean, it seems imaginable, but it's not clear, at least, that it's possible. There's no kind of proof this can happen. So that's why I was interested to see if there's any reason why it couldn't. Is there any general barrier to such events taking place? And that's how I ended up with this limitative result, self-organization, that seems to just sort of rule out, in very general terms, not just Darwinian evolution, but any kind of process that relies purely on the dynamics of the system to generate structure. And, well, many people don't think that the origin of life was self-organization anyway, because they appeal to vast amounts of time and enormous numbers of planets in the universe and this kind of thing, which suggests that they're appealing to brute force, just in terms of the numbers. So in my paper, I just assume we've got self-replication going on and then ask, how can this develop into complex life?
Yes, and of course, you actually quote in your paper Dr. John's Richard Dawkins talking about how the origin of life occurred because there are just these vast probabilistic resources. You know, you quote Dawkins talking about hundreds of billions, you know, of planets. And so Dawkins just thinks it was essentially a lucky one-time event. Is that basically right?
Well, I suppose his point is that you don't actually need that much luck if you've got enough planets, and that, which is correct, I think, you know.
Yeah,
the
sure,
numbers
sure.
Actually work out, yeah.
If the numbers work out, sure. Mm-hmm. And that's the big question. Okay, well, Dr. Johns, thank you very much for coming on the show with us today and talking about your new paper in Synthes. Again, it's titled Self-Organization and Dynamical Systems, A Limiting Result. We've got a blog up on it on evolutionnews.org, and you can also go to Uncommon Descent blog and read more about this paper. So, Dr. Johns, thank you so much for coming on the show with us today.
Thank you, Casey.
Well, I'm Casey Luskin, speaking from Seattle, Washington, with the Discovery Institute. Stay tuned for more on ID the Future. Thanks for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute 2010. For more information, visit www.intelligentdesign.org or www.idthefuture.com.